Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. Sam here, just wanted to put a really quick cover note on this podcast. We sat down with Martin Ayres last week. Martin is a former tour pro based out in Australia. Coaches a number of players, specialises in coaching players who've been great players, who've lost their form, who want to regain that greatness again, which is just a really cool and fresh take, and you'll kind of get why when he rolls into it. He's a really good bloke. He's got the most intense level of love for the game. It's infectious. Some great stories in here about Grant Waite and coaching Steve Elkington, some really cool stuff. You're going to enjoy it. It's a long podcast, but there's some fascinating stuff in there, particularly how talking about, you know, moving in on the shot and all sorts of stuff. So look, without further ado, it's over to the pod and we hope you enjoy.
Watch this.
Martin, good to finally see you after having spoken on the phone. How are you?
Yeah, you too. Good to see you too. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. It's been something. Yeah, since we first talked, I've been looking forward to having a chat with you guys. I've listened to your podcast quite a bit. I'm a podcast person. I like to listen to podcasts. So yours is now in the rotation. So it's been good.
Perfect. Great.
Nice. What's your tipple, yeah, Martin? What's your tipple on podcast?
Well, I do. I'm a big fan of the, as far as an enjoyment listening wise, the Shotgun Start Boys. I like them. I like certain elements of the No Laying Up stuff as well. I'm not going to name names as to who I don't enjoy on that whole thing, but they're a good group of young guys, young compared to me, talking about golf. So I like listening to that different perspective, you know.
Did you enjoy the one with James Day, the one we did?
I did. I listened to that one. I think was it you? Who was talking to him?
It's me.
Yeah.
Okay, I played with James in the we'd played golf at the Addington and then recorded it back in his workshop.
That's where it was. Magic. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, so, you know, obviously that's how you guys heard about me, was through James. And yeah, he's... his little workshop in the back there is something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like two worlds. You got the simulator, the best simulator that Urban Golf has, right? The best room, the most elegant. And then you just go around the corner there. And then here's James Day's massive workshop, just chock full of goodies, you know, like amazing old gear.
And it's not organized at all, is it? They're just everything's strewn all over the place.
I think there's a
kind of crazy doctor at work. He's just,
I think he's the one that it's organized in his mind. That's the main thing. For everybody else, it looks like chaos, but I think he knows exactly where everything is.
To be fair, I'm not really sure I'm on speaking terms with James at the moment, because he was building me a set of clubs and I questioned whether you needed to weigh the grips, and at that point he absolutely lost his shit with me.
You have made a gross error. Gross error.
Why did that? I cannot believe you asked that question.
It's essential. Yeah, it's essential. If you're gonna do everything else to the tolerances that James does, and you don't weigh the grips, what do you do? Like, you might as well not even do any of the other things that are precise.
Yeah,
right.
Meeting people like James has been a bit of a. That's probably the best part of doing all this, to be honest with you, Martin. Like, the podcast is great, but mainly because it's a mechanism to meet really cool people like yourself, James. People who just have this obsessive interest in the game of golf, which I think we share, but because there's so much distance between us, you know, until you meet them, you kind of just feel like you're a nutter on your own. And then you realize actually there is this like community of complete and utter sickos out there.
That's right.
So I thought we'd try and keep this as much about your journey in golf, really, Martin, and the stuff along the way. I mean, there's going to be so many good war stories. So you've just got to make sure we don't skip past any absolute gold in there, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think, from my point of view, what I feel I would be interested in talking about, because I wouldn't want to sort of relitigate my playing career, my junior playing career and all that. I just like to sort of, I think the start's interesting, and then the kind of middle where I went to college and all of that was interesting, because then I turned pro and then it kind of went south, and that's interesting. But I don't want to make that all, you know, I don't want to make that the whole thing.
No. Where you've gotten to now, where you've arrived at is,
That's the interest for me. That's the interesting thing, because it's who I want to reach and help in golf. You know, they're both the people like me who could play and then absolutely couldn't. And then there's the people, many, many golfers out there who'd be listening to your podcast who didn't get to play much as a kid. And so they started playing when they're a bit older. And so they never got that, the kids, imaginative, intuitive learning of the game, you know, that if you did play as a kid, you got that opportunity because you weren't going to be technical and thinking about how you're doing it. You just played the game for the game itself, you know.
And do you think that's almost two types of players then? Sorry, Martin.
Very much so.
Like yeah, you've got those kids that were brought up on it. I mean, I was, Bruce was, you were. Yes. But then people who come at it later in life, it's
an entirely different, might as well be a completely different species, mate. It really is that different because at the same time, that different species has like the same issue now, in that you guys, I don't know about you, but I can't go and play like a kid anymore. So no. I've lost that ability. Mm. Right. I can't turn my mind off to that extent. It's just not possible. I've tried. It's not possible. So I'm now having to play golf the way these gents and ladies who never picked it up as a kid have to play, which is that they have to somehow know enough about what they need to do to forget about that and go and play golf. Instead of, so I always talk about, it's like you're either playing the game or you're playing yourself out there. Mm-hmm. And by playing yourself, I mean you're thinking about what you're doing, where your club is, you know, what's the next move you're making, when really it should be about the ball and where you want that to go, right? Oh, I want to hit that ball there. You know, that's the game, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The game isn't, I want my club to be at 37.5 degrees halfway back and I wanted it 42 degrees halfway down, you know, something like ridiculous analogy, but you get the idea.
I mean, that's a cracking sort of just teaser, I guess, for what's going to come ahead. But that world where the junior golfer is kind of unconsciously just moving around the ball and doing what they want to do, and then presumably a lot of really good junior golfers graduate to become, you know, elite players, and then they start thinking angles and club positions. Does some of that mirror your own sort of experience in the game and your playing career?
Completely.
I mean, talk to us about your sort of like growth in the game, I guess, or your sort of entry point into it and everything.
Yeah, well, I started out when I was about 11, I think, and I couldn't join the course I wanted to join and play. I'd played two or three games of golf at various courses in Sydney and loved it. And my dad's like, all right, let's go join a club. Because he had given up golf to follow our sports. And he was like, oh, the guys want to go play golf. I mean, you know, so my dad's a golf nut. But so I had to wait 6 months to join the Cromer, the course I wanted to join. So I went to this other place, Wakehurst, and played there for 6 months. Then I joined Cromer at 12, and that was when you were allowed to join there. And from that point on, I mean, when I was 15, I was playing off a 3 handicap. So I picked it up pretty quick.
Wow.
And, you know, it was like, in essence, when I was 15, I qualified for an Australian tour event, which was crazy to think, but I had caddied. I'd caddied for a guy when I was, it is bonkers. So I
learned 3.5 years after picking it up, you're there sort of in the professional ranks essentially.
Yeah. And I missed the cut, but it was great. You know, obviously what an experience that was for me. So I was just one of these people. And to be fair, I did wag a lot of school. So it was 3 years, but I did get a lot of practice in. Don't worry. So
you racked up those 10,000 hours pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So, but I learned the game quickly, and I'd say that what characterized why I learned it so quickly was my imagination and the intuitive. Like it was for me, it was really about the game. I had played a lot of rugby, and so I was a pretty competitive type of kid, and for me, it was like the ball. I want to get this thing in that hole, right? So when I hit it in the trees, for example, I'd get quite frustrated with myself, but I wouldn't get frustrated with myself and go, why did I do that? What was wrong? You know, as a kid, it was like my ball's in the trees. Off I go into the trees to see if I can escape from there onto the green. And so it was really all about what's next and what's ahead of me and what's out in front of me, not what am I doing. I never thought about what I was doing, right? And, you know, I had a coach. I didn't see him very often. He's a great old coach. John Kelly is his name. And he played World Cup for New Zealand. So he was a fantastic player in his own, you know, in his own way. And really all he told me was a few little grip things, chipping and some bunker stuff. And, you know, he didn't tell me how to swing. He never told me how to swing. He just taught me the game, you know. And so he was a brilliant mentor for me at that age as well, because he could recognize in me that I didn't need to be told how to swing or anything like that. It's just like a little tweak here or there to my grip, you know. So that was the first, really, that first 3 or 4 years set me, that was enough to get me to going to college golf, because I'd won a lot of junior tournaments and stuff like that. And so the next phase was going to college, I think, in America, which is a totally different thing altogether.
I mean, that early phase there, Matt, you mentioned it's quite sort of forward looking, for want of a better description. You're thinking about like the next shot. It's everything that sort of psychologist tries to reverse engineer now and talk about, you know, kind of staying present, all that stuff. It just sounds like it came very naturally to you there as a kid. I mean, what did sort of practice look like? I mean, you know, you kind of hear a lot of sort of juniors who are sort of in that creative mode, you know, the going into the trees story you mentioned there, and whether you're trying to hit a draw or a crazy slice around trees, I guess it's all quite playful and just fun.
Yeah. For me, no, that's it. You're 100, like the course I grew up on was like this, corridors, right? Trees. Yeah. And so if I hit it far enough wide to the next fairway, then I had to hit it up and curve it over. But if I hit it in the trees, I had to hit it down and curve it the other way. So I learned all those shots very quickly and very easily. Again, just through having the shot present itself, and a bit like what, you know, Phil Mickelson would say to Bones, it's like, there's a gap there. It's like, well, if there's a gap, I'm going to have a crack at it, you know? So it's really, and you're right. It is all about the if you think about the psychology, this is a little quick story, but I had a mini tour player I was working with in America. And he says to me, I'm really just having trouble playing one shot at a time. So we're on the range and I thought, okay. So I dropped two balls down. I said, all right, hit two for me at once. And he looked at me and he's like, what are you talking about? I said, well, you can't hit one at a time, hit two for me, you know? And he just, obviously he cracked up and he lost it. He just did. It was almost like that. He's like, yeah, I'm being stupid, aren't I? And I said, well, you know, we are golfers. So that is kind of the direction we go.
Yeah.
So
just pressing on that junior analogy, Martin, is there, do you think the best players in the world today are just better at kind of channeling their inner junior golfer a little bit at the right times? You mentioned people like Phil. You know, I feel like, same as you, I feel like a totally different golfer now to what I was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And there's good and bad parts of that, but a lot of the time it does feel like you're thinking technique rather than outcome. Do you think you see the best players in the world who are a lot more?
Yeah, I think for our viewers to understand that, or listeners, whoever's listening to the, understand the landscape of golf as, you know, because there's so many good players out there now, and every one of them has a very unique swing. Wouldn't you agree? Like Victor Hovland and Colin Morikawa and Matt Wolf, three guys who came out together, they have completely different actions, the three of them, right? And that's great. That's great for people who are now in the game to understand that the shape of the swing has got nothing to do with the actual quality, right? Because when we grew up, when I was in the worst era, I'd say, and Day as well, maybe you guys were at the tail end of the worst era of golf instruction / mental torture of golfers with all this positional corrective garbage, right? And so we were really greatly affected by that. I know I was, and I'm assuming you guys have been to some extent as well. And where I think things are on the mend is with the data-driven stuff, the TrackMan stuff now, it's more about what the ball's doing. So that goes back to my junior day. Like all I cared about was what the ball was doing. And so they've got a TrackMan there for every shot they play. And it's like, the ball did this. Oh, okay. That's interesting. The ball did that. Great. Okay. Wow. I'm getting more spin, or it's coming down, you know, on a more vertical landing track, which is great for these firm greens I'm playing, and so on. So they're more concerned with that than the minutia of the details of their swing. And I think that's what we're seeing now with guys coming out, more unique swings, not cookie cutter positional teaching. And unique swings that all work. And so, yeah, they're able to maybe maintain more of that junior than, say, players who came up in our era.
Mm. You know? So just weird. Circling back on your story a bit there, Martin. So first few years, it seems like the game is coming pretty easily, and you head off to college into America. What's that? What does that look like? I mean, how do you kind of progress and move on from there?
Yeah, that's good. So my first year over there was great. So I contended quite well in some tournaments. I didn't win any, but I was, you know, from an average point of view, I was on a good team at University of Louisiana at Lafayette, and all the good players were sort of older. I was the only new player in the team. And, you know, I had the best scoring average on the team the first year. And it sort of got a little bit worse from there every year for me until the last year, where it started to pick up again, which I'll touch on. But it's the second year there was the first time I dabbled with some swing stuff, you see.
Right.
Very first time ever. And one of the reasons was, at my course growing up, there's just corridors of trees, you know. And then when I go to America and play, and you guys have probably seen this if you've gone to Texas or somewhere like that, where there's houses both sides. Right? And although it's quite a wide gap between the houses, right, it's houses. It's out of bounds, both sides, right? It's like, so that started to sort of do a bit of a number on me.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I grew up with no internal out of bounds or not, certainly not OB both sides, you know. And so as I started to maybe get a little bit more nervy about that, I started to think, okay, well, what can I think about that'll take my mind off that? And so it became the swing. So I started thinking about my swing, which was, you know, frying pan and fire type stuff, right? I would have been better off just thinking about the out of bounds, you know.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
This story. You're a swing guy. You're a swing guy as well. It's like,
I get called a swing guy. I don't think of myself as a swing guy.
You wouldn't call yourself a swing guy?
No, I wouldn't, no.
How would you describe it?
I'm a golf guy. I love the game. I think all I care about it, the swing is a means to an end to hit a shot, right? So I'm a shot guy.
Love that.
So it's a part of the shot, but it is only a part. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that anyone could take away from this conversation, me talking about golf, has nothing to do with the swing. It has to do with the fact that the ball's just sitting there, right, on the planet somewhere specific. Like, it's really somewhere specific. So there's somewhere around there that you can stand that hitting your shot is the easiest thing in the world. And everywhere else that you stand that's not that makes it harder. Okay. And then there are places most amateurs go where they've got no chance and never had a chance. And they haven't even swung yet, right? They haven't gotten themselves to where they've got a chance. Right. So what do you do from there? Well, you can try and hit the ball where you want it to go from where you are. It's bloody impossible. And Tiger Woods couldn't even do it. But here you are giving it a crack. And then you say, oh, my swing's shit. Hold on, buddy. You had no chance.
You set yourself up failure.
Yeah.
So leading on from that, is that kind of, I think I've heard you talk about it in those great videos that you put out with James Day, Urban Golf on YouTube a few years back. It's sort of for want of a better phrase, I think, structure as to where you locate yourself in space, which I guess, you know, not wanting to butcher this too much, because I'm sure you give us a much better explanation, but you can basically allow yourself to kind of make a motion at that one spot, and the ball is kind of incidental.
Yeah, so it can become that way, see?
Yeah.
So you know that, I think we're getting pretty deep into that. I think this is good. I like talking about this, but if you imagine okay, here's my best analogy for this. You've got a pool player, say, or snooker, Ronnie O'Sullivan, okay?
Mm.
He's got his structure, that his basic thing. Now, most shots he can play from that structure because the table height's the same, right? But every now and then a ball will be up closer to the cushion. Now his bridge is on the cushion instead of the table, right? So now his bridge is a little bit different. So it's slight change of structure, but it's still, it's very defined. His cue is going to go very straight, right? It's not going to go like Ronnie O'Sullivan's cue doesn't go like this. It's like super straight, right? And so what he does is he goes in there and sets up his shot on the angle for the red so that he can get to the black later on. And it's like, yeah, right here. And he shoots it. Or he says, no, that's the wrong angle. So at that point, when he says it's the wrong angle, he takes the whole structure and moves that. He doesn't just move a piece of it.
Mm.
In golf, I'm aiming the club face. Okay. What about everything else? Like it's all the same. It's all one thing, right? Mm. So it's a whole structure. So to your question, if you are familiar with your good structure, you and the club, then it's a doddle. It's quite easy to know that you're in the right place to flush the ball because there's the ball and here you are, right? It's like you're already there. You're like, yeah, I can hit this. Right. Whereas if you're there in pieces going, this is square to the target and this is square to the target, and meanwhile the ball's over there going, hey, I'm over here. Come on. Right. So it's that compartmentalizing of it in what you were thinking in your mind is, if you've got your structure and you can take that to the ball, then you can say, okay, where's the target from there? And if it's not where you want to be, you move like Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Mm.
But you've got this whole thing that's real. Then you've connected it to the ball. Perfect. Now, where's that going to go? Okay. Oh, there.
Mm. Yeah, it's a much more sort of holistic way of seeing it than the kind of piece by piece, position by position that I guess has been the norm for, I don't know, the last 20, 30 years. I mean, going back to your time in America then, so it kind of started in your second year and just gradually became a little bit more addictive or compelling as a way of approaching the game. You just thought, if I can kind of break this down piece by piece, that'll make me better. Was that kind of where you go?
You start craving consistency is what I think most people would agree. When they're struggling, they just, I wish I was more consistent, you know? And so you start thinking that the consistency would come if I had a consistent pattern of movement. And as we've just had a conversation, the consistency in a game that changes every single shot, it's a brand new shot each time. Consistency is not down to just the swing, you know, it's the way you play. So I think I might have even made my swing better. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like the swing work that I was doing might have made my swing technically better, but I wasn't playing the game anymore. And so the other important facets of playing a shot, I wasn't even doing them. Not, you know, properly, because I was so focused on how I was going to swing this club that I didn't go to the right place.
And you're under a bit of pressure under a collegiate level, aren't you? Because you know, your scoring average goes towards your starts and you want to be in the side, because if you're not in the side, you're going backwards. And then that whole thing then becomes self-perpetuating, I guess, because you can't, you're back in the cycle of more swing stuff. All of a sudden scores aren't getting any better. And then you say it kind of comes out a little bit by the end of college, right? So where do you go after that? So you start playing quite well back into college. You then, you know, a playing career beckoning perhaps?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. I met another coach. He was an Australian. My dad had met him through a different sort of avenue. And he kind of gave me a bit of a new lease. He was one of these old school teachers who just, he'd tell you what to do, but it would be abstract enough. It's not like this whole series of things to do. It's just one or two abstract things. And he really got me hitting the ball well. And to the point where I, after having come back and seen him in Australia, I went back and for the whole season, I played pretty well my last year. And then, so I went back after college and played some amateur golf in Australia, getting ready to go to the Q School for Australian Tour. Back when we had a tour here in Australia. So more on that another time probably. So, but that was, you know, I got my tour card first time. That was fun. And I was really playing well. And then my first year as a pro again, I was playing well, scoring well. I didn't get much opportunity at the top level of Australasian golf, but I played at sort of the middle and lower levels, the pro-ams and the what you call the challenge tour type level of the Australian tour. So I played all of that stuff and did really well in that. And so that was encouraging, you know. But then it got worse every year after that.
Okay.
In the same sort of pattern again, right?
Was that so just I did the same thing. You were trying to sort of push it on and say, okay, you know, I've competed really well at this level. You sort of the mid level you're talking about there, and like I want to kick on now. And I think it's just, I guess it's just a natural human kind of train of thought, isn't it? I've got to do something different to elevate myself. So what are you go searching for?
Yeah, exactly. And you think, okay, now how am I going to get better? So I would play with guys like I played with Grant Waite in the New Zealand Open final round. I mean, he just absolutely wore it out, you know, and just three wood off the tee, just absolutely wore it out. It's stunning ball striking, right? And here's me. I mean, my good shots are as good as his good shots, maybe even better, to be honest with you. But man, I hit a lot of bad shots. And so it was playing with guys like that. And because I knew, you know, he'd back from the US tour, right? So everyone knew who Grant Waite was at the time. He was known as a ball striker. But when you see that and you know where you feel you are, and you're like, okay, well, you know, if I can get there. And a quick funny aside on that, I missed a 4-foot putt in that round where I hit it a bit too hard and it went sort of 5 feet by, and I made the one coming back and we're walking off the green and Grant Waite's telling me that I'm hitting my putts too hard. And I just thought the irony of him giving me a putting lesson in the middle of the New Zealand Open was too much, because the guy, if he could putt at all, he would have been a superstar. You
know? Yeah, it is funny, isn't it? What players who are just sort of lacking in maybe one area kind of observe in others and trying desperately. They're focusing on that a lot. And I mean, he's someone even today who is held up on social media and all sorts of places as just being an absolutely prodigious flusher of the golf ball.
That's right.
I don't know what his background is, whether he was sort of that's something that's really been kind of with him his whole career or how he's cultivated.
I would say so. I mean, I think anyone, again, this is where the junior, see, this is what you this is what you lose, right? So when, without thinking about my swing as a kid, I, within a very short space of time, obviously figured out how to just go into a golf ball where I needed to be to just flush it really pure without having to do anything, right? Just pound it. Right. If you walk up to imagine walking up to a nail that you're holding in, right, with a hammer, right? You don't just go in and hammer. You measure it and then you hammer. Right. Well, that's golf. And if you're not paying attention to the measuring thing, and then you swing and you're like, ouch, what happened? Right. Mm-hmm. So I think Grant Waite probably, like me from a young age, just knew where to be to just pound it. And I've actually worked with Mike Weir a bit, and Mike told me some funny stories about Grant. I won't repeat these, but his time with Grant Waite, you know, and they're still good mates from what I understand. And so he's worked with some of the same guys I've worked with. So I'm familiar with what he teaches, and, you know, it's very much in the Mac O'Grady type mold. Mm. And he's a great advertisement for that method, I'd say, with his own abilities.
Mm. So. I guess there's a whole other discussion we could possibly have there at another time about, you know, how he's maybe a good advertisement for the Mac O'Grady kind of breaking down a swing in that sort of way.
Yeah.
But how much of that has he applied to maybe his own game versus is that a sort of outcome of kind of actually just kind of getting rid of maybe a lot of the clutter that people who follow that approach, I guess, end up building up, because it does seem, as an outsider, I'm not being fully immersed with it, as an outsider looking in, it looks quite sort of analytical and put this here and then here and here. Whereas actually maybe the reality with someone like Grant is that he's kind of flowed through those positions totally subconsciously as a result of just being much more in the mold of kind of, where do I need to put myself? And, you know, I'm just going to let this out. I'm just going to make this one motion. I'm just going to let it all out. I mean, sort of playing with guys like that, you're saying there, you're looking at how you can improve and progress. And where do you feel like it started to sort of deteriorate then in your own context there?
Well, it deteriorated from that premise. Now imagine if the things that I tried to do were correct or potentially helpful, then it would have been good. But that wasn't where I went, was the other way. And what I've learned since, and that was actually quite a protracted decline. Right?
So it wasn't rapid.
No, it was a very protracted one. I could play enough I was out there for 5-6 years and had good enough results in that time, even as my game was trending downwards. So for example, this is a kind of a classic case of my career is I get to the Western Australian Open and I'm swinging it like dog crap. It's terrible, right? I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I need to make some cash, obviously. And I'm over in Perth away from home. I'm spending money. I need to make some cash. What do I do? So I decide, okay, I'm swinging it like crap. I'm just going to cut every ball. Okay. I'm just going to big cut. And so if I've got a 7-iron in, I'm going to take a 6-iron and just cut it into the green. So I shoot 12 under for 4 rounds and finish 4th. And it's like, great. Right. So, yeah. So like Stephen Leaney had just finished 2nd in the US Open and he wins the tournament. I'm like, I've just finished 4th to Stephen Leaney. It's not a bad week. And my swing wasn't, I just cut every ball. So here I am now, I'm playing junior golf, right? Which is like just cutting the ball. No swing thoughts at all.
Right? Yeah.
And that's the best check I made that year, where my swing was, I'd given up on my swing, completely given up on it. Wow. So that kind of tells the story.
I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I can imagine a lot of the people that listen to this, this is quite refreshing to hear. The fact that when you're, you know, things aren't going quite right in your game and you're talking about an elite professional level there, Martin, but you know, just to the club golfer that's struggling on a weekend or the Saturday medal, the thought that actually maybe it's not about just going straight back to technique and swing and positions. Maybe this is just about getting into a more comfortable position where you feel like you can make a pretty good pass at the ball. You know, the whole thing's quite refreshing to hear. But it crept in, and then eventually it kind of just got to the point where it just got too tricky to play professionally anymore.
Well, it just got, I mean, for me, I then injured my shoulder, just slipping over on a wet floor, landing on it wrong. And then so I never really got back to physically where I needed to be. So the gradual decline in my game became catastrophic at that point. Lost my card, you know, wasn't going to get it back. And so I still continued to try to improve my golf. I still was trying to figure this thing out, you know. Mm. And after I rehabbed properly and got myself going, I started going to Japanese Q school every year, and I would do that. I would teach at a Japanese golf school and then all year and then go to Japanese Q school was my thing. But I wasn't competitive, right, mentally, because I was teaching all year and whatever. So that was tough. That was a different thing altogether. But anyway, so that's kind of winds down. The playing career was basically self-suicided, would be the way I'd call it, right? Because some people, I know like Bradley Hughes, for example, who's now quite a well-known instructor, he was a fantastic golfer, okay? And he blames instruction that he received for his decline, and I'd agree with him. That's true. I'm not blaming instruction, right? It's my own, speaking of the club golfers, and I'm speaking to them now, their own idea of what they need to do is fundamentally wrong. Okay. So if the more you listen to yourself, the more likely you are to harm yourself. And I say that with absolute sincerity because people just have no idea what to do. If they just played, right, and let the game sort of tell them what to do, they'd make all these good decisions. But then they think, oh, I need to get my swing here or I need to get it. No, you don't. I'm sorry. That's actually not going to help you. And I think that the average club golfer could benefit a lot from learning their own experience. Like you mentioned it earlier, they got a new swing thought. They play the first four or five holes. It worked last time, but it's not working this time. So they give up on it. Then they start hitting the ball well.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, it's like,
how does that make any sense?
It's like my career. I played a good week when I gave up. I was like, my swing's shit. I'm not even going to worry about it this week. I'm just going to cut the ball. Played great. Okay. It's like a microcosm of that is every day that people play golf. They're like, I'm going to start, but I'm going to do this today. Right. And they give up on that. If not by the second hole, then by the third, they're already onto something new. Right. That it's not really a good strategy, is it? If you're going to give up on it three holes into an 18 hole plan.
And there's not many parallels you can draw with other sports, are there?
No.
You know, I can't really think of any other sport where the amateur or the professional would be as hit and miss with, you know, thoughts, different techniques, things that they would try and implement for a short, medium, long term. You know, the fact that you can almost go polar opposite, you know, week to week with the thing you're working on. It's just, I don't know.
That I just can't think of any other sport or like, you know, pursuit, just to expand it beyond a sporting context, where you can have really accomplished individuals in that one specific field who are just by all accounts exceptionally good at what they do, and they actually go out with a really noble intention of, I'm going to do something to get better, I'm going to perfect myself, this sort of ethic of self-improvement. Mm. And then they just lose all that ability that they had. It's like, 100%. I don't know where, you can't see that happening in, you know, football or cricket or going to the gym or, you know, it seems like a much more linear kind of progression. And yet with golf, it's just, there are so many stories out there of really accomplished professionals who change their equipment, change their swing, change their approach to it. And guys like Tiger and Faldo who have rebuilt it, I mean, you could make an argument that maybe they didn't make themselves any better. Maybe they would have been even better without going through the huge overhaul. They're like sort of the vanishingly few exceptions to this rule. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for a start, you bring up Tiger there and this whole thread of conversation here. I love it because I have a sort of joke where, you know, Tiger having the chipping yips back in 2015, right? Mm-hmm. That's like Einstein forgetting the times tables.
Right. Yeah, Einstein, he was four irons, wasn't he? And all sorts of stuff.
Like, he's completely lost it. Now, that makes, to your point, in what field of human endeavor, forget sport, anything, would someone who's a virtuoso like Tiger, who can't do the most basic things, it's mind-blowing. Now, this is what I love about this whole, I talked earlier about where you are thing, because nobody thinks about that fact. And yet when I say that to you, you guys can't deny that fact. The ball is somewhere, right? Now, there are places you could stand around it where you can't do anything. You can't even reach it, okay? But then you get in close enough where you can reach it. But is that really the best place? And so whatever happened to Tiger, it doesn't take much for the best player to lose the sense of where he needs to be. And he said it himself. He didn't know where the bottom of his swing was. It's true. Fairly, it's true.
Fairly fundamental point of the game, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. But I would argue this is that he would have, if there was no ball, he would have known where the bottom of his swing was if he just asked him before the swing without a ball there. But because he wasn't setting up at the right angles for that shot, this is James Day. Okay. Hopefully he'll listen to this and he knows that was the crux with his short game. You guys probably both know he hits the ball fantastic and he's probably still struggling a little bit with the short game, is he?
We're still playing the shovel bunt. So he plays that shot, which for me as someone who struggles a little bit with the short game, it makes total sense. He keeps the sole of the club so close to the ground on the takeaway because then it has almost no, if the only thing you're doing from, you know, I don't know, 45 degrees out and your backswing, is lifting the club off the floor at that point. You can't bury it in the floor. It's already on the ground. It can't go anywhere. Yeah. So he's playing the short shots like that. He calls it a shovel
professional
bunt.
He plays a professional top, something like that.
Yeah, it's like a hockey shot. It's like a hockey sort of like sweep.
That one, yeah. No, that's good. But see,
I'm just going to say this is a bit harsh on James because he hasn't got a right reply in this sort of context. No. So
at the end of this.
Yeah. I'm not slagging him off, but he is an instinctive golfer. He's like, he's a great player. He's a proper ball hitter, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he flushes it. So the difference there, see, in the the reason I bring this up is for James that when it's a full-on action, his action's fantastic and he hits great shots. And then, but in the short game, what specific thing is the game asking you to do? Okay, more than anything, because it's easy to chip it straight, right? What it's not easy to do is chip it the right trajectory and spin and energy, right? So it's like it's easy to chip it 20 feet by. You blade it, or it's easy to It's easy to duff it a foot in front of you, right? People know this, but it's much harder to hit it 20 foot offline. And so the need to have the right energy and the right angles of trajectory and everything is quite a demanding thing. Now, most of that, a good player, a good chipper, will achieve before the swinging motion itself. So the technique of chipping is more how do you arrange yourself so that you can just chip the ball. And that's James spent a lot of years building it to where if he just chipped the ball, it would go over the green because he just didn't know how to bring it all of his full swing setup and everything down and make it small enough to where, as Hogan said he could hit a 10-foot chip or a 300-yard drive as hard as he can because he built it small enough that he can just hit it. So, you know, I was just going to say to round that off is that some players struggle with that. And the reason they struggle, again, is a fundamental misunderstanding of what's required of them. They think it's their technique that's got a hole in it, or they think I've got the yips or whatever. And they may have the yips, but it was developed from this not understanding where they need to be.
I can identify with that. I know Bruce is itching to come in here, but I can totally identify with that stuff. And like, we play a lot of golf together, me and Bruce.
Yeah.
We've just gone back from playing in the Netherlands. You can see it, can't you, Bruce, when I'm in sort of, when the chipping goes, I'm in technique mode and I'm thinking about club, where all sorts of parts of the body are that are completely unrelated to the shot. And I suppose I can see that as well in any golfer I play. You know, Bruce is on the pod with us. I can see that in Bruce when Bruce doesn't hit it so good. He's going into himself thinking about positions of the club head and everything rather than thinking more around the shot and the positions and stuff. It's fascinating. You did touch on Hogan there. It would be, I don't want to walk by that. Do you draw quite a bit of inspiration from Hogan and how he looked at the swing? And, you know, if so, what parts? You know, he's a fascinating character. How much are you kind of into Hogan and his sort of philosophy around the game?
I was into it so far that it wasn't funny because I had really, I'd seen something in the way his club behaved, right? First and foremost, his club was so free.
Mm.
And so what actually led to, there's two things that led to my current swing philosophy. First one was I was watching Tiger and I saw that he was going in one direction the whole way. And people say, what are you talking about? Because he's obviously turning right, he's turning left. But he through his length of his body, he was just going in a sort of expanding wave where his hands start down close to him, of course, and then the hands go away from you, and then they come back, right? And so that wave is not, in my mind, back and then back down the same line. It's waving away and then it sort of drifts over to the side and comes back. And so I always saw that as one direction, or I did from that moment on. And that helped me hugely. All of a sudden, I told you about my injury, all of that. The moment I started employing that framework in my mind, power came back to me instantly. And I was always a very powerful player until the injury. And I'd lost 30 yards, never got it back. It was never coming back. And then all of a sudden, instantly had it back because I wasn't throwing energy away. I was just watching Tiger sort of keep all the energy with him and then have that thing go around him in motion. So then seeing Hogan doing what I saw was the same thing, except he had this flash of freedom. And I was like, I want that. I want that freedom. How can I have that,
Martin?
Yeah, don't we all? That's what obsessed me with Hogan, was the freedom with which he swung. And so that sort of set me off on Hogan.
Was he a shot guy? I don't know, just based on what I read about him. Was he more of a shot maker, you think? Because maybe this is unfair based on what I've read, but I always thought that he was the guy that was just digging out of the dirt in the range week after hour after hour, just beating balls. But he was still working on shots and moving around the ball and trying to make the ball do different things, right?
I would say 100%. I think he understood. There's no doubt he understood his swing, but he understood his swing from a framework of what it was, what his job was. For him, he wanted to play the best shots. There's no doubt at his competitive level. He even said the very words is like, there's not enough daylight to practice all the shots I want to practice. He didn't say there's not enough daylight to work on my swing. Yeah. So I think he had the swing well and truly licked. You know?
And I think it's interesting. You find this with a fair few great players. That book, Five Lessons, which he wrote, and was it Anthony Ravielli did the illustrations for?
Yes.
That's come in for quite a bit of criticism in terms of it making has. A lot of golfers worse, weakening so many people's grip, flat swings, all these other kind of points of criticism that have been directed towards it. And I think it doesn't, I don't know whether that's necessarily grasping the right end of the stick. I think it's more, what it's really driving at is that a great player like Hogan wasn't really a sort of factual level aware of what he was doing in terms of positions and how to manipulate the club. And when he was kind of asked by a publisher to kind of present that to a mass audience, it just doesn't really capture what he's about, because a lot of that is kind of resultant, it seems to my mind, the flashes of freedom and how beautifully like sort of balanced and the sort of rhythm that his swing has when you see it online. Yeah. That's not, you can't, you know, he doesn't really capture that in words and pictures.
No, it's a very book, difficult thing to capture.
And there's feelings that are maybe quite persuasive where he talks about having five right hands or whatever. And, you know, there's perhaps truth in that, but because it's such an individual sport, I guess, you know, how you kind of describe something in terms of feel to one person might be quite different to someone else, and maybe that's where that work has been kind of misinterpreted, because it's not a work of mechanics and positions or geometry. It's, you know, the thing about Hogan is that he was, he kind of, as you put it beautifully there, Martin, he was hitting all the shots. He was a shot maker first and foremost rather than a swing maker.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're 100% right. It's a very difficult thing to explain. Okay, and so here I'm going to get on Hogan's side in this court case against him like you said, there are many critics of Five Lessons. In the introduction to Five Lessons, Hogan says, if you wanted to show a child how to open a door, you wouldn't open the door and say, see, there it is. You would instead show them how to open the door. So if you put that in the golf context, this is in the introduction, before any of the instruction. I'm going to show you how to swing, not what it looks like, not what you should take on board as my swing looks like or anything, you know, his swing, how it works, what works inside it. Okay. So that was the context. And then at the end of the book, so you got the beginning, he sets a context which most people just blew by, right? And they're looking at it from a modern standpoint of, we know what happens, right? So he's showing you what happens, but he's showing you what creates what happens. And then at the end, he reverses the order and he says, you can have this if you have this, and you can have that if you've got this, and you can have that if you've got this, okay? So to me, those two bookends around the five lessons, for me, that's the book. That tells the story of the book. So if you're not seeing the book through that lens, and I didn't, the first book, I had to work that out. Like, it wasn't like the first reading, I'm like understanding what's going on. But I think it's so important to understand that what you do is not what the camera sees, or what, even when you're playing with each other, when you're watching your own swing, your playing partner swings, what you're seeing is from over here outside looking in. They are performing it from where they are, almost inside that, looking out. It's a completely different perspective. And people say, well, golf's a game of opposites. It's like, maybe it's a game of not opposites from an opposite perspective. That's just one way to look at it. It's like what you do in looking out looks the opposite from out looking in. Why wouldn't it? It's like completely different perspective. Okay. So this is the sort of thing that has helped me come back out of wherever I went to, because I was trying to create shapes that I wanted to see from the camera.
Yeah.
I'm sure we've all done that. Right?
I still do it.
Okay.
Well, I remember my junior lessons. You talked about setup and stuff. I remember video lessons with arrows on a screen and working at where my club should be at the top of the backswing.
Did you get taught that as a junior? Now.
Yeah, I mean, you're a few years older than me, Martin. Yeah. I'm about 10 years older than Bruce. I would say we all had very different diets as a junior golfer when we went through it. And I remember there was a few like Ledbetter sessions that I had, not with Ledbetter, but Ledbetter Academy video, red lines on the screen. I remember our club pro, all he ever used to teach me was setup and then shoulder turn at the top of the backswing. And I was like, none of it ever felt productive. Like it turned me off lessons forever. Whereas Bruce, you've been a lot more, you're more sort of a product of some of the more modern swing instruction, I think. And you're an intense reader on the topic as well. So probably not fair.
Well, yeah, I was probably someone who was quite sort of instinctive with how I played the game and always had a decent short game and grew up, you know, playing with a brother, Harry, who's 2 years younger, who's just flushed the ball from a young age. And I was the kid who was, you know, although despite being a bit older than him, always a lot shorter and sort of skinnier, and would be hitting sort of rope hook drivers just to try and chase it out there to keep up with him off the tee. And he couldn't chip, you know, he was just, you know, he'd sort of hit two flush shots onto the green or near to the green, just miss it, and then, you know, sort of flub a couple and you know, blow his brains out or whatever. And you kind of have different you sort of have different approaches to it. And then as a result, I was like, well, I need to get better at the long game if I want to compete and get better. You know, my short game was like exceptionally good when I was young growing up. And then I sort of thought, well, I'm quite an analytical person. I naturally was drawn more towards trying to break things down, and the Mac O'Grady stuff's quite interesting, and how that's maybe been taken on by a sort of new crop of instructors in more recent times, and how they've pushed it on. And I mean, the thing now is you can measure everything, so you can measure all these things, such as, you know, the kind of ground reaction forces, whatever that actually means, I'm not quite sure, but you know, 3D,
but you're into it
stuff, you can put in all this stuff you can measure, and it's interesting, you know. There's obviously, you talked about the TrackMan ball flight laws earlier, Martin, like that's certainly put to bed, I think, a fair amount of doubt when as to how the ball, what actually makes the ball fly the way it does. And I think maybe over the last 5-10 years there's been more of an understanding from the sort of the physics standpoint or the biomechanics standpoint of what produces that kind of club delivery into the ball. But and it's helpful to a certain degree if you're just looking at the golf swing. But you know, everything you've just said there is absolutely right. You know, the 3D sensors or the kind of biomechanics gizmos are still looking very much out from a sort of outside perspective. There's nothing that can capture like human intention as to how am I going to move this club through space.
When they design the machine, okay, that can get between me and the club, right, in that sort of realm, whatever it is, it's not even a space, right, because the club's attached to me, can get in that realm, then you can start to talk about my interaction with the club measured, right? But this is it. I played with Steve Elkington last week. It was great to catch up with him and his son Sam. I hadn't seen him in a few years with the pandemic and everything, and he was talking to me about this latest thing that they'd gone on, which was this 3D stuff, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, they found some things that helped them, to your point, you know, Tom. It's like there is good information in there. Absolutely. You can see the most good players doing very similar things. Okay. So you say, okay, well, that's what's good. But it's still an open door in Hogan's language. So we've shown you the open door, and that is that the pelvis moves this way. But it doesn't tell you, because the pelvis isn't an independent thing. It doesn't move by itself. So the pelvis is part of the whole thing. So what is it that the player's doing that gets the pelvis to move that way? And when is he doing it, or she, right? So it's like you're not getting that information from the data. You're getting the information of what happens. You're not getting the information of how to create it. Because if you create it in and of itself, absent what the good players are doing to create it, then you're not getting the benefit. You're just not. So yeah,
totally.
Yeah. So there's a, you know, I'm not against technology at all. In fact, the more information I have, the better, because I have a filter through which that information goes. And I know that I'm not going to suddenly start going down the road of, you know, trying to hit positions of my body or the club anymore. I'm done with that, but it's still good information. So I could make the case that what Elk told me was happening with the pelvis and how Sam had changed his, and his swing looked better than ever. So I was like, beautiful. You know, the way the pelvis moves, I said, well, that gels with the way I believe the feet engage the legs, which engages the pelvis to start the swing. And so it's like, but that's how I would get it to happen, right? As opposed to it just move your pelvis.
Yeah.
You know? And so those two things are, they're not the same thing.
Sort of jump on the back of that. Yeah. Cause I think the missing link here is kind of that intention, it seems to me, or like, what are you actually trying to do when you're stood over that ball? And yeah, video cameras, the 3D plates you mentioned there, all this stuff, they're great reference points. And you could maybe identify and say, well, you look, how you're using the ground there isn't particularly efficient. We don't see that in great players, or, you know, the angle that the club's on halfway down in the swing is a bit steep and you're probably going to hit, you know, some pull hooks from there or some wipey cuts. But, and that might be valid, but I don't think any instructor out there, or the vast majority of instructors out there, I should say, are really able to necessarily identify what causes that, because ultimately this golf swing seems to be, certainly with better players, to be a chain reaction that of sort of things that are happening, and where you sort of decide that starts to break down is the kind of $1 million question, which
yes,
we all get a different answer depending on which instructor in quotation marks of a sort of technical disposition that you go to. You'll get a different answer because they might all agree that it's sort of deficient at one place, but that's a result of, you know, what's gone on previously. And I think how you identify the root cause of something is, it's just really, really difficult in the current way of looking at the golf swing.
That's probably the, you know, one of the sad indictments of the game these days is that, and I want to circle back around on Elk. You mentioned Elk there. I know you worked together for a number of years. I want to circle back around on that in a minute, but there's so many people out there that now just offer titbits, don't they? They just want the golden bullet. They just want the quick thing, the quick fix. Yeah. There's no one out there that's really invested in the craft of the process and loving it. And, you know, Bruce, you're probably an exception as someone who's super into understanding all facets of it. But most people just want to get, how do I cure my slice? You know, how many times are there videos just, how do I get rid of my slice? You know, it's like that itself is probably driving everything around swing understanding in the complete polar opposite direction of where someone like you would want it to go, right, Martin? Like you know, want people to understand the game, not just quick fixes, you know?
And I think the game is the key word there, because if you've got an approach to the game that isn't going to detract from your ability to swing, in fact it does the opposite, I think. And there's two basic approaches. I'll outline the one that most people employ, and they do it, it's logical, it's linear, it makes sense. That is that you go in and you aim. Okay, that's the first thing you do. You agree that that's reasonable?
Yeah.
You aim.
It's a good start.
Then you get your stance and you posture and you get yourself ready. And then hopefully you make a good swing. And if you do that, you'll hit a good shot, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's a normal, logical approach to it. That's what it looks like the best players are doing. They aim, they posture, ready, you know, and then they make a good swing. But that's nothing like what golf is. Okay. That's not how it's played at a decent level at all. It's more like Ronnie O'Sullivan. So Rory, when you watch him, or Tiger, or Brooks Koepka, or any of these top guys, they just go into the ball and they become their shot. They do that instantly. And then from there, they target that. So they target their shot hitting the ball, going to go there. Oh, well, I'll just move here. Okay, shoot. So it's a completely different order of things. Aiming. Okay, that's good. That's done. So I'm aimed. Okay, now I'm postured. Okay, that's done. Good. Okay, now it's time for the swing. It's like, it doesn't work that way. It's all together all the time. And so I think that's the number one problem with people's golf. If they actually understood just to play golf like they play pool or snooker, just to start there, even if their swing's kind of crappy, right? It's still going to be better long term for their swing and their game than thinking, oh, I'm hitting it offline. I've got to really make sure my alignment's good today. It's like, all right. Well, that's not it. So here's a, just to finish this off, alignment, okay? You picture your alignment stick, right? Parallel to the target line. Okay. Every millimeter you walk left as a right-hander on that alignment stick, perfectly aligned, every millimeter you move sends it at least a degree further right, the ball. Okay. So as you walk left, the ball goes right. As you walk right, the ball goes left. Plus, it also changes, you know, other angles. It's not merely that. It's changing everything, in fact. So an alignment stick does not give you alignment. Okay. It's three-dimensional.
Yeah.
The ball's round. So what you need to think of is instead is the ball's round. I have to go around the ball and that selects my line. Right. So think of it, it's like a gun turret on a ship. Right.
Yeah.
It that can go around 360 wherever you point it, it shoots. And how do you point it? Well, you go around the you go around until shoots it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not when alignment sticks are they're nothing.
So you said just in your first description there with the alignment stick, just to kind of clarify that. So
yes,
that stick that's parallel on the ground, you're saying, for want of a better phrase, if you're moving it up, the ball up in your stance from a kind of two-dimensional standpoint or back, that's actually, people don't realize that's having an effect on where the ball's going to start.
Precisely.
It's not just a case of, are you stood open or closed? It's like, well, where's the ball? Where's the ball relative to your sort of left heel?
So
there's that whole three-dimensional aspect.
Yeah. Well, this is so like that alignment stick. So there's one tiny little spot on that along that stick where you could say it's straight. And everywhere that's not that tiny spot, it's no longer straight. And yet the idea of the alignment stick is to align yourself. But you don't need to align yourself. You need to align the ball that you're going to hit shortly in the future. You need that ball aligned.
Yeah.
So how do you do that if you don't do it with intuitive, imaginative anticipation of what's about to happen? That's what a good golfer's doing. And I say all this, I know it's kind of a complicated thought process. I hope someone's not doing this at 6 o'clock in the morning like I am to try to wrap their head around it. But just think about the fact that if you're playing football, okay, and you guys, two guys are just kicking the football, and Sam, you kick it over there and Tom's got to go get it. Tom doesn't run to where the ball is. He runs to where it's going to be. And if I was to throw a ball at you there, Sam, and you caught it, right, you wouldn't put your hand there where the ball is at any current time. You'd put your hand where the ball's going to be and then you catch it. You're like, well, how did you – is that voodoo? No, it's athletics.
It's
athletics.
Yeah.
It's sport. Okay. So in golf, the ball's not moving. So we think, okay, it's not moving. So I can aim, get in a posture. Right. Now, if I just make a good swing at 110 miles an hour, we're in business. Right. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, okay. Elite.
Right. And rather, you think, okay, I've got my 6-iron in my hand here. Okay, this is what I want people to try and take out to the course. I've got my 6-iron. I'm ready to hit it. I go in there. I'm ready to hit it. Okay. Oh, it's going to go left. Okay, let me just move. Okay, now it feels pretty straight. Okay, whack it. See what happens. Can you play that way? I know you can, right? You've got the ability. Everyone listening to this has the ability to do that tomorrow. It's not like they've got to learn how to do that. They've got to just decide to use that skill that they already have. The one that if you fire through a ball, Sam, you'd catch it. It's no problem, right? Although you Englishmen, I don't know about your slips catching. You're not known for that. But let's go back to the football analogy, right? You guys are great at the football. So, but if you kick it off to the side of someone, they run to where it's going to be, okay? Just use that same thing, apply it to golf. And say, okay, maybe my crappy swing, as crappy as it is, that's what's coming, but I know I've got my club. I can hit this ball, okay, from here. Where's it going to go? Just ask that question of yourself. Where would it go if I hit it from here? And you'll get an answer. And you're like, well, how did I know? How do I know where it's going to go? Well, you know because you can preview the future. just like you can in any other sport. Even though the ball's not moving yet, it's shortly going to be moving. And you're anticipating that movement, just like you do in other sports.
Crazy. I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, Bruce, but when I, like, what you were talking
about in there. Sorry, I've called Bruce Tom twice now.
Don't worry. It's quite all right. You know,
I thought you were talking about Tom as well. Also on the podcast. It's fine.
I know, but see, that's the problem. I listen to you guys without the faces. And of course, I haven't talked to Tom ever. I've talked to Bruce, but I'm calling Bruce Tom.
We had an hour prelim call, didn't we? But the thing is, funny enough, Tom, you know, Tom will be listening to this, obviously. And he, you know, bringing it full circle in a way, he's someone who's actually picked up the game later on. And so the stuff we were talking about at the beginning in terms of that kind of childish innocence you have, I think he can speak to what it's like to maybe pick the game up later on and just all of a sudden it kind of feels quite stifling and quite sort of claustrophobic in a way, or just you haven't got that maybe that freedom.
But that's where I was going with this. I was like, when we play sometimes, Martin, we drop to half a set, and when you drop to a half set, you immediately have to start making shots because you've got to think about I'm going to have to hit that 7-iron low hard at the back foot. It's probably going to turn over, or I'm going to try and take a load off a 5-iron or whatever. All of those different shots start to come through your mind. And then I think you naturally become a better shot player when you do that. And so many interesting people that just don't do that. They just want to kind of go around 14 clubs in their bag. Like you say, rinse, repeat, max every shot out. It's just, you know, there's so much you're mentioning there that I think resonates with people. I do want to talk about Elk and some of your other stories as well from your time as well. So you worked with Steve Elkington for a number of years, right?
Was really one full year, and then there was a hiatus for a couple of years, and then when he got back out on the Champions Tour, we reconnected for a short time. But we just obviously stayed in touch
because you're obviously both great players. I mean, both fantastic players, but also
I was nothing like him, so. I was a good player, but
we're talking I just want to clarify different levels.
I want to clarify. I definitely was not like
it. but you're not like some instructors out there who kind of have the interest in the game kind of the academic sort of sort of understanding of it. But you know, you've gone out and you flushed the ball and shot 12 under hit hard, four rounds. So you're not bad.
Fair enough.
What was that like? What did that look like? You know, I can
tell you that just to run to the end of it, when he played at the PGA at Whistling Straits, which he was leading with two holes to go, and he hit it over the green on the 17th at the flag, and he said later to me, he said, I couldn't hit that ball over that green. There's no way with that club. So what do I do, right? So and that cost him the tournament, but he was playing golf, and I'll just say it, back to the comment you made earlier about us both being great players, I didn't know golf could be played that well. I was watching him that week. Yeah, on the Tuesday that week, I contacted his friend Terry Okura, and I said, Terry, he's going to win. Okay, I told my mate in Australia, I said, get on him, go large, he's winning, right? And so he almost did. But the thing is, even though he was playing golf that I couldn't – had. Not even conceived could be played that well, right? And I'd seen a lot of golf, right? But he had six, seven other guys around him that were in contention with him. So it's like that's the level we're talking about to win a major, okay? So it was real eye-opener for me.
Was he on the Champions Tour at this point, or was he kind of late
40s? He was 48, 7, yeah. 47, 48, yeah.
But Rory was knocking on the door of his first major.
Yeah, Rory was there.
20s, you know, early 20s, I'm guessing.
Rory ended up finishing, I think, either one ahead of Elk or tied with him or something like that. So it was he was one of the guys that was in there. So, you know, the start of working with Elk, he had done what I believe we all do. When you make a decision of what you're going to do with your swing, the chances are that the movement you decide to make is going to detract from the quality of your swing. And so as good as he is and as much knowledge as he has, which is a lot, he was going the wrong direction. Right. And I sort of could see that, you know, I had this one directional idea from Tiger that I picked up. And so the way that I got Elk back into that one direction was with this sort of abstract movement, right? And he took to that straight away. He got the what he called the smash on the ball that he'd been missing. And he parlayed that into an unbelievable season run for him that sort of culminated in that PGA. So his mate Terry, that I mentioned earlier, he said that Elk's never played this much golf in a row. So he must be playing well because Elk would only leave Houston if he thought he could win. Because he didn't want to leave he's a family guy. He just like, I'm not leaving here to go play unless I'm serious about it. And so that shocked Terry that he was week after week after week, he just kept playing and playing and playing. So that was fun. I got to see it all up close, which was great.
And what does that look like? You know, when you've got someone there who, because I've seen some of his work, I don't know if this is subsequent to that period of time, I'm guessing it is, but you know, Secret Golf, and I think he's worked with the likes of Jackie Burke and Bradley Hughes as well, and he's kind of looked at it maybe from a golfing machine kind of geometry standpoint, but you know, clearly when he's playing well, he's just sort of freed it up there to the point where, you know, he's just keeping it very, very sort of intuitive, I guess.
Yes.
How does that look like when you're kind of working with him and you're trying to, I mean, is part of that just trying to stop him going down that sort of tempting rabbit hole of like, let's go and anchor this in something tangible like geometry or swing position? No, how do you keep him away from that?
No, he would say he's very into math and science and he is, but he's more into golf. Like he loves golf more than anyone I know. Okay. He plays golf every, I bet you he still plays golf every day. Right. So, and he's not, hasn't played Champions Tour for years, but he'd still play golf.
Just loves the game. Just loves it.
Yeah. Loves golf. So he was never interested in taking what we were working on and making it concrete. He wanted to understand it about it. And we did talk about what it's creating, what it's doing. Right. But not from a positional standpoint. He didn't need it from that point of view. So if you watch him play golf, if you go back and look at the YouTube highlights and whatever, he goes in, he takes a little swipe next to the ball, right? And that's his sort of imprint of, you know, what I said earlier, when you know what's coming. Yeah, it's like it's the future, right? Here's his little glimpse at the future. He goes in and shoots it. There's no complicated – he's not going in there to do seven things. So when he trains it to become one thing, takes that one thing in and shoots that one thing. And that was obvious to me. He didn't say that to me, but that's obviously what he does. When I watched him up close, it's an incredible process. And, you know, it's a sort of mystery to me why he didn't win. Like he won 10 times on tour, 2 players, championships, et cetera. It's kind of a mystery to me and one major, but it's a mystery why he didn't win more because he really has, you know, it just tells me that there's so many good players out there. That's what it tells me, you know.
It's a long career as well, though. It's a really long career where he was playing in, you know, major championship golf and stuff. And like you say, it just brings into sharp focus, you know,
not many
how difficult
are
it is to win.
Yeah, not many are contending at that age and against that field, you know. Bubba was there. Martin Keimer won it. DJ was there, but for that penalty, you know. I mean, these are the top echelon of players, aren't they?
So, yeah, and almost like a generation later. You know, just like thinking about players, maybe just a few sort of slightly abstract questions here, Martin, but any players you see today that from a swing point of view, just think maybe they're totally misunderstood, i.e. the golfing world just completely misunderstands them or they're underrated or players that fascinate you today that you look at and think, give us a little sort of peek behind the curtain on how you look at it.
Well, Brooke Henderson would be the first person I mention. Her swing is unbelievably good. It's insanely good. And from my point of view, because of what I've learned from watching her, I'd put it up there with what I learned from Tiger was transformational for me, just that one directional movement that I talked about earlier. And if anyone wants any, you know, I've got some videos going up on YouTube that'll clarify that one direction, but it's a bit hard if you're not seeing it. But then the Hogan, the freedom. See, what came out of the freedom was I realized that Hogan could have that freedom because he was so structured. But Hogan was so structured and so balanced and so perfect that everything blended in, just all blended in. And so with Brooke, she's just a little bit outside that Hogan mold of everything blended. It's sort of a slower, more neutral type loading into a very much a Hogan type process from there, in the sense that it's from the transition to the finish is just a flash of perfection. Okay. Right. But it's how she gets there that taught me the sequence of the swing. And it changed my mind as to the sequence of events from the beginning through transition. It's like that really helped me. And she epitomizes that sequence beautifully. So that's one player that, you know, people, I think, yeah, she's not rated poorly or anything, but I know some people think she should change her swing. I'm like, no.
Don't touch her. Just don't go
near her. Yeah, please. Like, just leave her alone.
I mean, the men's game looks quite interesting, I guess, from the, you know, bearing in mind the discussion we've had over the last hour or so, in terms of, you know, the shapes that you see out on tour now, particularly at the top level of the game. You mentioned earlier that you think, you know, maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, maybe even more recent than that, that was the sort of nadir of golf instruction because it was so very prescribed. Like, there is almost one way to swing a club, or there's a couple. And now we can look at the top 20 players in the world and say, well, there's a huge variety in terms of the shapes to the swing. But you know, how do you see that now? They've all got this fundamental sequence and dynamic at play.
They I believe
slightly differently. You know, someone like a John Rahm or a you know, has that same sequence, but it just looks different to a Matthew Wolf or a Hovland or a, you know, take your pick.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, there's a sequence of events, and then there's the rate at which that sequence unfolds, right? And what changes between these players is not so much the sequence, but the rate. Okay. And so John Rahm I'd put on one end of a spectrum and Matt Wolf on the other. I love both of their swings, you know, and I think that's what's great about, you know, this modern game. Again, if you think that the shape of the swing is of crucial importance, then you don't understand what you're talking about, because John Rahm's there with that shape and Matt Wolf's there with a completely and utterly different shape, and yet they both are fantastic ball strikers, and they're both, you know, I know Matt Wolf's had his issues and whatever, and he's gone to live and all of that, but that guy is, he is some player. I mean, when Morikawa won his PGA, Wolf was right there. Yeah. And he finished second to Bryson at that US Open. So, I mean, you know, he's not...
it's a game of fine margins. You lose half a stroke and your scoring average, and all of a sudden you look very mediocre at that level, don't you? But he's good talent. Yeah, mentally.
Yeah, and he's got some off-course issues. And it's not easy being out there on tour. I don't care. Even with all the millions of dollars that the guy's got, it's just, you know, it's not a very hospitable environment. It really isn't. If you're a little bit soft, which is nothing wrong with being a little bit soft, if you're a sensitive sort of person, there's a lot of shit going on out there that could get you down. And, it's just because, you know, there's just so many things pulling you in so many directions, and not only do you have to deal with all that, but you've got to get yourself in there and shoot that ball, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a tough line of work. Not that I'm, you know, hey, they get paid well, so it's a good job, but it is a tough one.
What do you think the one thing that you absolutely, I don't know, what's the one sort of thing that just keeps you coming back with golf? Because you, like, by your own admission, you just love the game, right? You love you love the swing, you love golf at like the most intimate level. You're totally and utterly obsessed with the game. How can you explain why? Like, I think we all have our own attachment to it, but in the search for all the stuff you've done in your career and working through the swing, you must have at times thought, what is it that keeps dragging me to this? Like, what's the draw? What is it?
I don't know. Well, for me, in my own case, it was back when I was in my early 20s, and even earlier when I was, as I said, that junior period, 12 to 15, where I really learned the game. I really wanted to play top-level golf, really wanted to play at the very top, and I kind of dug my own grave on that front, right? I gave myself no chance because of the decisions I'd made, and they weren't, you know, I didn't think I was trying to do the right thing, but I didn't. And so I'm obsessed in some ways of figuring out what is the right thing, because you know, I didn't do it. I did it quite innocently to myself. You know, it's decision to start swinging it a certain way or whatever. It's like, that's what's held me. It's held my attention for a lot of years now is like, instead of being a former player who lost his game, and I'm not being critical of any of the people that are doing this, but some of them are out there and they know it. The things that they worked on that made them sort of lose their game, they're now teaching like that to everybody, right? And it's because they don't know another way. And I started out doing that, okay? And I stopped. I was going home and I was miserable. I'm like, I'm not going to teach people the things that cost me my game, right? I'm just not going to do it. So I'm either going to find a better way or I'm just going to go do something else, you know?
Well, that's a really interesting point, actually, there, Martin. Yeah, you mentioned it when you were talking about your days kind of teaching and then going out to qualify on the Japan tour.
Yes.
And you know, that sort of got me thinking about professionals who have managed to maintain a high level of play with their own game while still teaching. And it just seems to be like there's vanishingly few of them nowadays who can really do that. I think Elk, you know, it seems like he maybe had a go at it, but then again, not really. I mean, Robert Rock seems to have done it a little bit out on tour, but actually it's quite a sad story that there's so many club pros out there who that you see, or just teaching pros generally who you see, who can kind of give what seem to be correct and very well-intentioned lessons, and yet they actually themselves don't really want to play the game because they've kind of almost built up so much kind of misery or just negative emotion towards applying that to their own game. And it's a shame that they can teach it, but they fall out of love with playing the sport largely as a function of how they see it. It's a weird contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah, it's I think in part, they're two different. They're two very different spaces you're in. So in the teaching space, you're really, really focused on the behavior of the person in front of you. I am anyway. Yeah. I'm not looking at the shapes of their swing or the angles. I'm looking at what are they trying to do. Okay. Yeah. And so, if I go out and I play with a student, I'm really focused heavily on their behavior and what they're doing. And so then I go in and hit a shot, and I'm a little bit all over the place, right? Which is fine. So I'm in teaching mode at that point. Mm. But even with myself in playing mode, now if I'm not teaching, I'm just going out and playing, which I love to do. My good shots now are better than they ever have been. And my bad shots now are still worse than when I played on the tour, because I don't play golf every day, hitting a bucket of balls and going out and shooting a score and all that. I'm experimenting like crazy out there. Like I'm almost trying to break things to see if they break. It's true. It's kind of what I do on a daily basis, because, you know, if I'm going to espouse certain things to do, I need to know how they're broken or, you know, and I actually get a lot of enjoyment out of pushing the boundaries of the things I'm talking about. And so because I'm still living on the edge of that, my game I'm not ready for the tour. So, you know, to do what Robert Rock does is great. I think that's a real testament to his ability just as a golfer to do what he does. You know, I don't know about his teaching, but by all accounts, he's a good teacher. So, you know, but he can certainly play.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting you put it like that, the different skills that you're sort of bringing there when you're looking at someone and you're coaching them. I guess it kind of speaks to how just fully absorbed you have to be in the golf shot. And I don't really know how I can put it better than that, or like more comprehensively than that, to actually move that ball to the spot that you want. It's more than just a case of, well, if I think of a couple of positions or, you know, apply a couple of kind of conscious thoughts to it, it'll all be fine. It's like a state of mind.
Bruce, like this is the thing. It's like you can have a couple of swing thoughts and it works for a while, right? But in the end, we all know how long's the longest lasting swing thought you've ever had, Sam?
Yeah, they've got shelf life, haven't they?
Yeah, Bruce, what's your longest lasting swing thought you've had?
Well, my swing thoughts tend to be have a shelf life of a pint of milk more than a fine wine. You know, they kind of go out pretty quickly. But no,
I hang on to mine quite a long time. Yeah, I can. I mean, I'll hold time at the top in transition is pretty much a catch-all for all my swing stuff. So I'll have that as a swing thought. you know, I've probably been hanging on to that for a year or two. Like I can go back to that, and that's quite a good crutch. But I don't think that's a swing thought. I think that's more than anything, that's just instilling timing.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's so much around the, you know, played a few holes today, played 9 holes, started thinking about kind of angles into out and stuff. For some reason, slicing it, you know, coming right across the face. More I was trying to do what I was trying to do to fix it, I was making the problem worse. And you sit down and listen to this and you're like, oh, it's totally refreshing actually. Just turn up, give it a free swing, get your body in a position that feels like when I'm playing at my best, that's where I'm at. And then go from there rather than trying to put yourself in a position that feels unnatural. I do agree. I think swing thoughts have their place though. Like, I think everyone needs their swing thoughts.
Oh, no,
like,
you know. Even if the swing thought itself is to stop you trying to do something, right? Yeah. In other words, it sort of fills the space that's there, right? So filling the space is a good thing. And for that, I like to have an abstract thought, you know? So maybe it's, I'm going to just freely let it swing left, let's say, or whatever it is. You know, it's just something that, you know, you've made a decision beforehand that you're going to do this. And that the fact that you've made that decision stops you doing anything untoward while it's unfolding. But it just, I'll touch back on something you just said there, Sam, about going out there and feeling what I was saying earlier. So if you give yourself permission to get ready to really hit the shot you want to hit, like you've got the ball there, you're the club, you want, okay? And if you just give yourself permission to take a look out there and sort of quickly decide where you think it will go. Try this on the range first, of course, but if you think it'll go at the target, just come back in and just shoot it at the target. But if you feel like it's going to go to the right, chances are that is probably where it would go. So move.
Mm.
Move yourself, the whole thing. Don't just move the club face or whatever. Just move to a different place. Everything,
the way you're approaching it, even right down to how you walk in on it. These sorts of things matter, you know, like.
Well, you're already in there, so don't walk out again and come back in. Just move around the ball. See, the ball's round, and if you move around it, it changes the line. That's the way to look, right? So alignment sticks should be round.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't get alignment sticks. I don't get them. Like, you know, Bruce, you've always got them down. I just don't get it. Like,
that's because I can't see it.
Yeah, I know.
My eyes, I just don't see straight. And I, particularly when I'm like over the ball, I use it more as a feeling of like just to almost experimentation, really, because I'm someone who kind of defaults to, I've got to do everything square. I've got to do everything nice and square and nice lines and everything's neutral. And actually I kind of almost use an alignment stick out on the course or a couple of them just to kind of throw me off and be like, oh wow, okay, like for some reason I'm kind of set up really far right and the ball's up in my stance, and okay, maybe that's why I'm not getting the squash on it that I want. It's but you know, just kind of not wanting to turn this into a sort of therapy session for mine and Sam's own golf, Martin. But no, I know, because I think I can give myself permission to maybe make a half decent point here. But I can vividly remember playing in a medal last year, and hopefully you'll come and play Blackwell when you're next over in the UK, Martin. But the 14th and 15th are back-to-back par fours. First time you play holes that are back-to-back of the same par at Blackwell. And I remember I just sort of like carved my tee shot off the 14th tee. It's obviously a tee shot, square stance, flat stance should be the easiest shot in golf, right? And I hit it into the trees and struggled kind of with ball striking all day. And then all of a sudden you're presented with a shot that's deep in the woods and you're kind of thrust back into that childlike mindset of like, here's a window. Okay, I'm just going to take 5 iron to this. And if I don't get this right, it could probably come hurtling back at me in the face and I'm going to maybe knock myself out or take 10. But you pull it off and all of a sudden you're like, wow, okay, that was like, I was just so immersed in the sort of the shot and where I needed to put myself to allow that ball to fly out and then curve back. And then, you know, stand up on the sort of next tee box, trying to hit a straight shot and you kind of knock it into the trees left. And then you have to hit like a, you know, a sort of hook the exact opposite way. And again,
and you can
sort
do
of force back into it and you can do it. And yet, despite finding myself on the fairway a few times in that round and, you know, obviously on the tee box, you're kind of starting from scratch there. It should be a very, very straightforward exercise. that seems like the hardest thing in the world. And you try and put these kind of pieces in place to keep you on track, like stabilizers. But when you're kind of thrust off the beaten track and you're given what should in theory be a harder, more demanding task, you know,
this is a fascinating thing, because if you go back to that tournament I told you about where I just cut every ball and finished fourth, right, after had no swing, this is where I went wrong back then, okay, and where you haven't necessarily gone wrong because you're now making this great point, but you could potentially go the wrong direction when you tell that story and you say, okay, what does that story mean? Okay, what it means is that the reason you're able to cut it out of the trees through a window and hook it out of the trees through a window is that you're tapping into something that turns you into a golf ball shot striking machine, right? Mm. That works. And then you get on the tee and you're doing all these things like aim well, get in a posture, just now I just got to make that good swing. You know, it's like it's not the same thing.
No.
And one works and one doesn't. And you're saying, well, why does it work on the harder shots? It's like, well, because of how you're approaching them.
Yeah.
They're not harder. Like in some ways they are, because they're more than a straight shot. But like, doesn't a 6 foot straight putt require the same precision as a 20 foot breaking putt? They all require the same precision.
Yeah.
Even though they're all different. So the shot out of the trees requires no more or less precision than the tee shot. So they're not more difficult, I would argue. They all require, like, to drive it perfectly requires precision.
Mm.
So you can't go up there and do it the wrong way. Now, in the trees.
Yeah, I guess what you're saying, you got maybe slightly bigger margin for error.
No,
like instead of hitting into a 30-yard fairway there off the tee, it's like, okay, I've got to hit this through a 2-foot slot. Otherwise, you know, I can't afford to miss this shot a few feet either way, because I'm right, he's going to hit a tree and come back.
No.
But it's
I'm not trying to belabor that particular point. What I'm saying is that you play the seemingly harder ones better because your approach to them is golfy.
Yeah,
I would argue your approach is golfy, and your approach to the seemingly easier one is not golfy. Then, since I believe they're equally difficult, even though one's apparently more simple, they both require precision.
Yeah.
When you do it in a non-golfy way, you don't do it very well.
Mm.
Right. So it's not really an easier shot. You can't play it the wrong way and get away with it.
Mm.
That was my point. It's like,
it validates what you're all saying, doesn't it, Martin? It validates it ultimately, which makes you, when you're talking about that, you look at someone like, you know, a Bubba Watson, who is very free when he stands over what looks like, you know, a typically quite a straight golf shot. And he would want to factor in a whole load of movement and want to picture something that's much more outrageous than a traditional golfer would, and then move around it in a completely different way. And, you know, he's happy to carve his own path in terms of the way he gets the ball in the hole. And I think, you know, as people who watch the game, and whether it's people we play with at our club or watch professionally, there's something very endearing about that. And I think if you're not going to make a living at it, it's nice to feel like you're a shot maker or a ball hitter rather than a technician and a surgeon at it, you know? So it's...
Yeah, well, I go back to Bruce's story. Like, that is the story of Bruce and me and golfers like us and you too, Sam. We play as young people.
Hmm.
We somehow have all this success playing golf a certain way, and then we all just throw that out. There are literally different ways to play. The way you describe you playing the shots out of the trees is a way to play a shot. And you could play the tee shot the same way, but for some reason you don't, because you've got options. You've got the option to do A, B, C, or D, and you've chosen C and D rather than A and B, and here we are.
Yeah.
So that was my
choice.
And I should have been able to more coherently make that point earlier, but that was what I was trying to get at, is that we all know how to do it because we've done it, but we don't accept the truth of that and say, well, actually that might be the best way to go about it. It seems like I'm leaving too much to chance though. In other words,
That was my kind of follow-up question really there, Martin, is that it's, I think maybe part of it is why it's so difficult, why we kind of fall into that that trap is because it almost feels like you're letting go of the steering wheel as a sort of analogy. You just, and I think for an analytical, logical, kind of rational person, it just feels like that it shouldn't be that straightforward. And I think there's,
that is
you've given me. But when we had our little kind of catch up before we scheduled this podcast and came on air, you know, there's an unbelievable quote I think that you tell in one of your students, that Cameron Beckman, who says that the hardest thing about this game is how easy it is.
Mm.
And I think that maybe sort of taps into it a little bit, is that it's almost you don't want to kind of give up all control.
Yes,
you feel like you've got to make it harder than that.
Well, now you're tapping into what I said at the very start, the type of golfers I want to help, which is most golfers, right, is ones that played when they were younger and then lost that youthful freedom. I think Podrick mentioned this, you know, young innocence versus old experience. And both have their benefits, but neither has both, you know.
Yeah,
the old guy's lost his innocence, and right. So to your point there is like you have this, there's no way that I can go out and play like a 12-year-old. I've seen too much, done too much, good and bad, right? And so, but let's make it not simple necessarily, but specific. And that's the difference. So when you're in the trees, specifically what you're doing, because you've got to curve it after hitting it through a gap, right? So you've got, there's a lot going on there. But with the lot going on there that you have to achieve, your approach is to go where you feel you can create that impact, direction, and curvature, and then you hit it on that angle, let's say. Just like Ronnie O'Sullivan goes in on the pool table, snooker table, there, I'll go on that angle and shoot the cue ball, which hits the red ball and goes off on the angle, right? There's a way to do that that isn't that complicated.
Mm.
And you could do that on the tee. You could walk into a direction, right? Get the club in your hands and ready to shoot in the right place for you to shoot it, and then look out there and go, yep, there it is. I'm on my line, and shoot it. You don't need it to be more complicated, but we think, okay, surely it can't be that easy. Right? There's got to be more to it, right? And, well, unfortunately, if you make it as though there is more to it, you're sort of spoiling the soup, so to speak. And so the reason it has to be only this much is because even though the ball's sitting there, right, you don't have all the time in the world. You have to be on an athletic timing, right? So you're in motion, you're in sequence, right? That's where the motion comes from. You can't just be a robot out there. There's just no way. I think everybody knows that. Good and bad players know that.
Yeah, and you can almost actually see a bad shot. I don't know whether this is a hopelessly arrogant statement, but I can feel like I can almost see a bad shot coming from a playing partner, and I'm sure they can see it in me as well.
Definitely.
When you get someone over the ball, and I don't know whether it's they freeze up and they don't have the kind of shifting, subtle pressure shifts that's going on in the feet, or just a looseness and a general... I think, generally they just kind of seize up and everything becomes static and they don't have the kind of that sort of dynamic balance that you need to have if you're going to get in there and just really kind of, point it and then shoot it with some real freedom.
100%. And there's actually, my friend Michael Powers, we've got Northbound Golf together, which we're on a bit of a hiatus. The pandemic's kind of kept us apart a bit, but nevertheless, our work is sort of geared around what you're talking about there. It's this rhythm that exists. There is a time that you need to be on, right? And it's the time you and the club in motion, right? Because it's about to happen at 100 miles an hour, right? So you have to get yourself on that time before it happens, because if you're not on that time before, you're not going to get on that time during, right? And so that's what you see when you see someone and you're like, oh, this doesn't look good, right? And conversely, when you watch a good player preparing and you can see it coming, you're like, oh, right?
He's going to wear out.
You can see it coming, right? That's Rory. Like Rory on the main just wears it out, right? He just sticks the finish. It's just, right? And off it goes 340 down the middle. Thanks for coming, right?
That might be my new favorite expression, actually.
You're wearing
going
it out.
Forward, it's just wearing it out. Yeah, I think.
Adji Gow's just absolutely wearing it out about that.
But yeah, I couldn't agree more. Martin, you've been at an absolutely fantastic chat to have with you on this on the podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time. We've almost gone for, I think, best part of a couple of hours, which has been amazing. And the worrying thing is we could easily do a couple of hours more, but we better let you go. For our listeners who want to find out more about the great work that you're doing and how they can look into this a little bit more, this very captivating way of playing the game, much more liberating way of playing the game, how can they find out more about it?
I've got a website with my friend Michael, northboundgolf.com, Michael that I mentioned earlier. And then also the YouTube channel. Currently I'd suggest, aside from going to Northbound Golf, to also check out the YouTube channel, which is Northbound Golf. Just search that in the and it'll come up. I've just put up the first video of a playlist. It's called Slam and Sam Snead's Secret.
Oh, great.
I think he had a secret, not just Hogan. And I don't think he necessarily tried to keep it. He put it in a book. So it's right there. That's the first video. And I'll be sort of from now on uploading some stuff to YouTube that sort of outline this, this different approach. And I think that what I said earlier, aim well, get in a good posture, make a good swing. It's a logical, linear approach to playing a golf shot. It's also fundamentally wrong and hurtful to your golf game. So, you know, I'll be putting content up that shows you how to deal with that.
And hopefully there's scope for us to do some stuff again in due course as well. Be that when you're traveling over, be that some more stuff in terms of looking at the swing and looking at some different things. Hell, I mean, you could just do 5 hours with Bruce on just group therapy and we could stick that behind the paywall. I think there's an audience for it. If you can fix my short game,
my full swing, you can do Sam's short game and chipping. I mean, yeah, we could just
we'll give you the full project of Tom. You can just do whatever you want with him. I mean, that's
that would be something I'd be very interested in doing. We'd do a little bit of collaboration there on the content sort of side of things. So I'd like that. And I think, you know, it is one of the things you asked me earlier, you know, what keeps me going with this, right? So what keeps me going from a teaching point of view, I know how much I can see, just like you can, Bruce, when you watch someone about to screw it up royally, right? I can see the potential in even the most base chopper, right? who has no idea what they're doing, okay? I know what they're capable of if they had the right idea.
Yeah.
I mean that, you know, it's not, I'm not trying to knock the most base chop, but you know, they're out there, people who just, they've got the wrong idea because they started playing golf when they're 45 and they never figured it out. And they never really had a chance to, because there's no information to take a 45-year-old and turn him into an athlete playing golf. Right. So that's my mission, is to, I know that people, it's not so much, it's not that I couldn't or wouldn't want to help someone like Steve Elkington again, get their swing going again. But I'm more interested in providing the information that can make the game vastly different from an enjoyment and ease standpoint for every golfer.
Yeah.
And the fundamentals I'm going to put out here on YouTube, I'll be honest with you, I think there's three or four of them. And I think in 5 years, if they're not the fundamentals that everybody's talking about, then I've failed. Because they are truly, I think they're transformational. So
powerful stuff.
I'm looking forward to I'm trying to get that out there. So I appreciate you guys having me on.
The pleasure has been all ours.
The pleasure's all ours. Yeah. I mean, what a great time. And Martin, once again, thanks so much for joining the pod. It's been class.
Awesome, guys.
Watch this.